Chapter 6. The First Month. 3 days after my arrival, I was ordered to go to work. The impression made upon me by my surroundings remained to this day very clear. There was nothing particularly striking about them, unless one considers that my position was in itself extraordinary. First sensations count for a good deal, and as yet everything was unfamiliar. The first 3 days were certainly the most unpleasant in the whole term of imprisonment. I told myself over and over again that I had reached my journey's end. I was now in prison, my home for many years. Here I would have to live. I had arrived overwhelmed with grief. Who knew but when I left I should do so with regret? I told myself all this as one touches a wound, the better to feel its pain. That I might regret my stay was a terrible thought. Already I felt to what an intolerable degree man is a creature of habit, but that belonged to the future. The present, meanwhile, was sufficiently grim. The eager curiosity with which my fellow convicts examined me, their harshness towards a former nobleman now joining their society, a harshness which sometimes took the form of hatred, all this tormented me to such a degree that I was only too glad to go to work in order to measure at one stroke the whole extent of my misfortune, to begin at once to share the common life, and to fall with my companions into the abyss. But all convicts are not alike, and I had not yet begun to distinguish from the general hostility a certain sympathy which here and there was manifested towards me. After a time, the affability and goodwill shown by several of the prisoners gave me a little courage and restored my spirits. Most friendly among them was Akim Akimich, and I soon noticed other kind, good-natured faces in the dark and hateful crowd. I consoled myself with the thought that bad men are to be found everywhere, but even among the worst there may be something good. Who knows? These fellows may be no worse than others who are free. Reflecting thus, I felt some doubt, but how right I proved to be. There was Suchilov, for example, a man whose acquaintance I did not make until long afterwards, although he was a near neighbour during almost the whole period of my confinement. Whenever I speak of the better type of convict who is no worse than other men, my thoughts turn involuntarily to him. He acted as my servant, together with another prisoner named Osip, whom Akim Akimich had recommended to me immediately after my arrival. For 30 kopecks a month, this man agreed to cook me a separate dinner, since I could pay for my own food and might not be able to stomach the ordinary prison fare. Osip was one of the four cooks chosen by the prisoners to work in our two kitchens. Incidentally, they were at liberty to refuse these duties, and to give them up whenever they thought fit. The cooks were men who were not expected to do hard labour. They had to bake bread and prepare the cabbage soup. They were called cookmaids, not from contempt, for the men chosen were always the most intelligent, but merely in fun, and they took no offence at the name. For many years past, Osip had been regularly chosen as one of the cookmaids. He never refused the duty except when he was out of sorts or when he saw an opportunity of smuggling vodka into the barracks. Although he had been condemned as a smuggler, he was remarkably honest and good-tempered, as I have already observed. At the same time, he was a dreadful coward and feared the rod above all things. Of a peaceful, patient disposition, affable towards everyone, he never became involved in quarrels. But he could never resist the temptation of bringing in spirits, notwithstanding his cowardice. It was simply his love of the game. Like the other cooks, he dealt in spirits, but on a far smaller scale than Gazin, because he was afraid of the risks involved. I always lived on good terms with Osip. To have a separate table, it was not necessary to be very rich. It cost me only 1 ruble a month apart from the bread, which was supplied free. Sometimes, when I was very hungry, I determined to eat the cabbage soup, in spite of the disgust with which it invariably filled me, until, after a time, my revulsion entirely disappeared. I generally bought 1 pound of meat a day, which cost me 2 kopecks. The old soldiers who watched over the internal discipline of the barracks were kindly souls, ready to go every day to market and make purchases for the convicts. For this they received nothing except a small gift from time to time. They did it for the sake of peace, for had they refused, their life in the prison would have been a perpetual torment. They used to bring in tobacco, tea, meat, anything, in short, that was desired, always excepting spirits. For many years, Ossip prepared for me every day a piece of roast meat. How he managed to cook it remained a secret. The strangest part of the arrangement was that during all this time I scarcely exchanged 2 words with him. I tried many times to make him talk, but he was incapable of keeping up a conversation. He would only smile and answer my questions with yes or no. He was of Herculean stature, but had no more intelligence than a child of 7. Suchilov was also one of those who helped me. I had never asked him for his assistance. He attached himself to me of his own accord, and I scarcely remember when he began to do so. His principal duty consisted in washing my linen. For this purpose there was a basin in the middle of the courtyard, round which the convicts washed their clothes in prison buckets. Suchilov found means of rendering me a number of small services. He boiled my samovar, ran to perform various commissions for me, got me all kinds of things, mended my clothes, and greased my boots 4 times a month. He did all this with the utmost zeal, with a businesslike air, as if he was conscious of the importance of what he performed. He seemed to have linked his fate to mine, and interested himself in all my affairs. He never said, for instance, "You have so many shirts," or "Your waistcoat is torn," but "We have so many shirts. Our waistcoat is torn." I had somehow inspired him with admiration, and I really believe I was his sole concern in life. As he knew no trade whatever, his only source of income was from me. It must be understood that I paid him very little, but he was always delighted with whatever he received. He would have been destitute had he not been my servant. He preferred me to others because of my greater affability, and, above all, my larger generosity. He was one of those fellows who never get rich, and never know how to manage their affairs, one of those who were hired by the gamblers to watch all night in the corridor, listening for the least noise that might announce the arrival of the governor, and who, in the event of a night inspection, received nothing unless it were a flogging for their lack of watchfulness. One characteristic of this type is a complete lack of personality, which seems altogether to have deserted them. Suchilov was a poor, meek fellow. All the courage seemed to have been beaten out of him, although he had, in fact, been born like that. On no account whatever would he have raised his hand against anyone in the prison. I always pitied him without knowing why, and I could not look at him without feeling the deepest compassion. If asked to explain this, I should find it impossible to do so. I could never get him to talk, and he never became animated except when, to put an end to all attempts at conversation, I gave him something to do or sent him on an errand. I soon found that he loved to be ordered about. Neither tall nor short, neither ugly nor handsome, neither stupid nor intelligent, neither old nor young. It would be difficult accurately to describe this man, except that his face was slightly pitted after smallpox, and that he had fair hair. He belonged, as far as I could make out, to the same company as Sirotkin. The prisoners sometimes laughed at him, because he had exchanged. During the march to Siberia he had exchanged for a red shirt and a silver ruble. It was thought comic that he should have sold himself for such a small sum, to take the name of another prisoner in place of his own, and consequently to accept the other's sentence. Strange as it may appear, it was nevertheless true. This custom, which had become traditional and was still practiced at the time I was sent to Siberia, I at first refused to believe, but found afterwards that it really existed. This is how the exchange was effected. A company of prisoners starts for Siberia. Among them there are exiles of all kinds, some condemned to hard labour, others to labour in the mines, others to simple colonization. On the way out, no matter at what stage of the journey, in the government of Perm, for instance, a prisoner wishes to exchange. Let us say his name is Mikhailov, that he has been condemned to hard labour for a capital offence and does not like the prospect of passing long years in captivity. He is a cunning fellow and knows just what to do. He looks among his comrades for some simple, weak-minded fellow whose punishment is less severe, who has been condemned for a few years to the mines or hard labour, or has perhaps been simply exiled. At last he finds someone like Suchilov, a former serf, sentenced only to become a colonist. The man has travelled 1,500 versts, about 1,000 miles, without a kopeck, for the good reason that he and his kind are always without money. Fatigued and exhausted, he can get nothing to eat beyond the fixed rations, nothing to wear apart from his convict's uniform. Mikhailov strikes up a conversation with Suchilov. They suit one another, and are soon on friendly terms. Finally, at some station, Mikhailov makes his comrade drunk, and then asks him to exchange. "My name is Mikhailov," he says. "I'm condemned to hard labour, but in my case it will be nothing of the kind, as I am to enter a particular special section. I'm classed with the hard labour men, but in this special division the work is not so severe." Before the special section was abolished, many persons, even in the official world of St. Petersburg, were unaware of its existence. It was stationed in some remote corner of one of the most distant regions of Siberia, and one was unlikely to hear much about it. It was insignificant, moreover, on account of its limited numbers, which in my time did not exceed 70. I have since met men who have served in Siberia and know the country well, and yet have never heard of the special section. In the rules and regulations, there are only 6 lines about this institution. Now, attached to one particular convict establishment is a special section reserved for the most dangerous criminals, and where the severest forms of labour await them. The prisoners themselves know nothing of this section. Was it a temporary or permanent institution? Neither Suchilov, nor any of his companions, nor Mikhailov himself even, can guess the significance of those 2 words. Mikhailov, however, has his suspicions as to the true character of the section, from the gravity of the crime for which he is forced to march 3,000 or 4,000 versts on foot. It is certain he is on his way to no soft spot. Suchilov, on the other hand, is to be a colonist, and what could Mikhailov desire better than that? "Won't you exchange?" he asks. Suchilov is a little drunk. He is a simple-minded man, full of gratitude to the comrade who entertains him, and dare not refuse. He has heard, moreover, from other prisoners that these exchanges are made, and he understands, therefore, that there is nothing extraordinary or outlandish in the proposition made to him. An agreement is reached. The cunning Mikhailov, profiting by Suchilov's simplicity, buys his name for a red shirt and a silver ruble, which are handed over before witnesses. Next day, Suchilov is sober, but he is given more liquor. He drinks up his own ruble, and after a while, the red shirt suffers the same fate. "If you don't like the bargain we made, give me back my money," says Mikhailov. But where is Suchilov to get a ruble? If he does not give it back, the convict's association will force him to keep his promise. The prisoners are most sensitive on such points. He must carry out his obligations. The association requires it, and in case of disobedience, woe to the offender. He will be killed, or at least seriously intimidated. Indeed, if the association once showed mercy to men who had broken their word, it would cease to exist. If a promise can be revoked and a contract voided after the stipulated sum has been paid, who would be bound by such an agreement? It is a question of life or death for the association, and prisoners in consequence adhere strictly to the rule. Suchiloff accordingly finds it impossible to withdraw, that nothing can save him, and he therefore agrees to all that is required of him. The bargain is then made known to the whole convoy, and if denunciation is feared, those whose loyalty is suspected are liberally treated. In any case, what does it matter to others whether Mikhailov or Suchiloff goes to the devil? They have had free drinks, they have been entertained without cost to themselves, and none reveals the secret. At the next station there is a roll call. When Mikhailov's name is called, Suchiloff answers present. Mikhailov does the same for Suchiloff, and the journey is continued. The matter is now as good as forgotten. At Tobolsk the convoy breaks up. Mikhailov becomes a colonist, while Suchiloff is sent to the special section under double escort. It would be useless now to cry out and protest. What proof would there be? It would take years to decide the case, and what benefit would the complainant derive? Where, moreover, are the witnesses? They would deny everything, even if they could be found. This is how Suchiloff, for a silver ruble and a red shirt, landed up in the special section. He was a laughing-stock, not because he had exchanged, though in general the convicts despised a man who had been foolish enough to exchange an easy task for a harder one, but simply because he had received nothing for the bargain except a red shirt and a ruble, which was certainly a ridiculous consideration. As a rule, those exchanges were made for relatively large sums. Several 10-ruble notes sometimes changed hands, but Suchiloff was so devoid of character, so insignificant, such a perfect non-entity, that one could scarcely even laugh at him. He and I had lived a considerable time together. I had grown accustomed to him, and he had formed an attachment for me. When one day—I can never forgive myself for what I did—he failed to carry out an order. When he came to ask for his money, I had the cruelty to say, "You don't forget to ask for your money, but you don't do what you're told." Suchiloff remained silent and hastened to do as he was bid, but he suddenly became very sad. 2 days passed, and I could scarcely believe that my remark had affected him so deeply. I knew that someone named Vasiliev was constantly dunning him for a small debt. He was probably short of money, and dared not ask me for any. "Suchiloff," I said, "you're in need of cash to pay Vasiliev. Take this." I was seated on my camp bedstead. Suchiloff remained standing before me, amazed that I had myself proposed giving him money and that I had remembered his difficult position, the more so as he had recently, on several occasions, asked me to advance him money and scarcely hoped that I would oblige him once again. He stared at the paper I held out to him, then looked at me, turned sharply on his heel, and went out. Astonished at his behaviour, I followed and discovered him behind the barrack. He was standing with his head against the palisade and his arms resting on the stakes. "What's the matter, Suchiloff?" I asked. He made no reply, and to my great surprise I saw that he was on the verge of tears.
"You think, Alexander Petrovich," he said in a trembling voice and trying not to look at me, "that I care only for your money, but I—"
He turned away from me, laid his forehead against the palisade, and began to sob. It was the first time I had seen a man weep in prison. I had much trouble consoling him, and thenceforward he served me, if possible, more diligently than ever. He was always on the alert for my orders, but by almost imperceptible signs I could tell that in his heart he would never forgive my reproach. The others continued to laugh at him, pull his leg, and even insult him at every opportunity. but he never lost his temper. On the contrary, he remained on good terms with all. It is indeed difficult, really, to know a man, even when you have lived with him for years. It was some time before I began to understand the significance of prison life. Although I kept my eyes open, I did not at first appreciate a number of facts that stared me in the face. I was looking at them from the wrong angle, and the only impression I received was one of unmitigated gloom. What contributed more than anything else to this view was my meeting with Aff, a convict who had entered the prison before me, and whose character had shocked me in those first few days. His baseness increased my mental suffering, which was already sufficiently acute. He offered the most repulsive example of that degradation to which a man may fall when all feeling of honour has died within him. This young man of noble birth, I have spoken of him before, used to inform the governor, through his servant Fedka, of everything that went on in barracks. Here is the man's history. While still a student, his evil ways had led to a quarrel with his parents. He went to St. Petersburg and earned his living as a common informer, never hesitating to sell the blood of 10 men in order to gratify his insatiable thirst for the grossest and most licentious pleasures. He was not without intelligence, but he gradually became so perverted in the taverns and brothels of St. Petersburg that he finally took part in an affair which he knew must lead to disaster. He was condemned to exile and 10 years' hard labour in Siberia. One might have thought that such a frightful blow would have brought him to his senses, that it would have caused some reaction, some change of heart, and brought about a crisis. But he accepted his fate without the least concern. It did not frighten him. The only thing he disliked was the necessity of working and of abandoning forever his evil life. The label of convict had no effect but to prepare him for new acts of baseness and more hideous villainies than any of which he had previously been guilty. I am now a convict and can crawl at ease without shame. That was the light in which he regarded his new condition. I think of this disgusting creature as of some monstrous phenomenon. During the many years I lived with murderers, debauchees, and proved rascals, I never met a case of such complete moral abasement, determined corruption, and shameless wickedness. Among us there was a parricide of noble birth to whom I have already alluded, yet there was plenty of evidence that he was much better, far more humane than Aff. During the whole term of my imprisonment, Aff was never anything more in my eyes than a lump of flesh furnished with teeth and stomach, greedy for the most vile and bestial enjoyments, for the satisfaction of which he was prepared even to commit murder. I do not exaggerate in the least. I recognized in him one of the most perfect specimens of animal passion, restrained by no principles, no rule. How his eternal smile disgusted me. He was a monster, a moral Quasimodo. At the same time he was intelligent, cunning, good-looking, had received some education, and possessed considerable ability. Fire, plague, famine, no matter what scourge is preferable to the presence of such a man in human society. I have already said that espionage and denunciation flourished in prison as the natural product of degradation, without the convicts thinking much of it. On the contrary, they made friendly relations with Aff. They were more affable with him than with anyone else. The favour shown towards him by our drunken friend the governor gave him a certain importance and even moral superiority in the eyes of the convicts. Later on this cowardly wretch escaped with another convict and their escort, but of that I shall speak at the proper time and place. At first he hung about me, thinking I did not know his story. I repeat, he poisoned the first days of my imprisonment so as to drive me nearly to despair. I was terrified by the mass of baseness and cowardice into the midst of which I had been thrown. I imagined that everyone else was as foul and cowardly as he, but I made a mistake in supposing that everyone resembled Aff. During the first 3 days, when I was not lying stretched out on my bed, I did nothing but wander about the prison. The authorities had supplied me with a piece of linen, and I entrusted it to a reliable man to be made up into shirts. On the advice of Akim Akimich, too, I obtained a folding mattress. It was of felt, covered with linen, as thin as a pancake, and very hard to anyone who was not accustomed to it. Akim Akimich promised to get me all the most essential things, and with his own hands made me a patchwork blanket from a pile of old trousers and waistcoats which I had bought from various prisoners. Clothes issued to convicts became their property when they have been worn the regulation time. Then they are sold without delay, for however much worn an article of clothing may be, it always possessed a certain value. All this surprised me, especially at my first contact with this strange new world. I became as low as my companions, as typical a convict as they. Their customs, their habits, their ideas influenced me thoroughly, and externally became my own, without, however, affecting my inner self. I was astonished and confused, as though I had never heard of or suspected anything of the kind before, and yet I had known, or at least been told, what to expect. Direct experience, however, made a different impression on me from the mere description. How could I suppose, for instance, that old rags still possessed some value? And yet my blanket was made entirely of tatters. It is difficult to describe the cloth used for prison uniform. It resembled that thick grey cloth manufactured for the army, but after being worn for some little time it became threadbare and tore with abominable ease. The uniform was supposed to last for a whole year, but it never did so. The prisoner works and carries heavy burdens, and the cloth naturally wears out and is soon full of holes. Our sheepskins were intended to be worn for 3 years. During the whole of that time they served as overcoats, blankets, and pillows. They were very durable. Nevertheless, at the end of the 3rd year, it was not uncommon to see them mended with ordinary linen, although they were now very much worn. It was always possible to sell them at the rate of 40 kopecks apiece. The better-preserved ones even fetched 60 kopecks, which was a very large sum in prison. Money, as I have said, had a sovereign value in those places, and a prisoner who has some pecuniary resources certainly suffers 10 times less than one who has nothing. When the government supplies all the convict's needs, what can he want with money? Reasoned our chief. Nevertheless, I maintain that if the prisoners had not been allowed to possess anything of their own, they would have gone mad or died like flies. They would have committed unheard-of crimes, some from weariness or grief, the rest in order to get punished, and, as they say, have a change. If a convict earns a few kopecks by the sweat of his brow or at considerable risk spends his money recklessly like a silly child, that does not prove, as might be thought, he does not appreciate its value. The convict is greedy for money to the point of madness, and if he throws it away, he does so in order to procure what he values far above money, liberty. Or at least a semblance of liberty. Convicts are dreamers. I will speak of that further on in more detail. At present I will only remark that I have heard men condemned to 20 years' hard labour say quietly, "When I've finished my time, please God I'll..." The very words, hard labour or forced labour, indicate that the man has lost his freedom, and when he spends his money, he is merely satisfying a natural craving. In spite of the branding iron and chains, in spite of the palisade which hides the free world from his eyes and encloses him in a cage like some wild beast, he can still obtain vodka and other delights. He may even, on rare occasions, manage to bribe his immediate superiors, the veteran officers and non-commissioned officers, and persuade them to close their eyes to his breaches of prison discipline. He loves, moreover, to swagger, that is to say, impress his companions, and persuade himself for a time that he enjoys more liberty than in fact he does. In short, the poor devil longs to convince himself of the impossible. That is why convicts take such pleasure in boasting and exaggerating their own unhappy personalities to the point of burlesque. They find in boasting the one thing they long for, a semblance of life and liberty. A millionaire, indeed, with a rope round his neck would surely give all his millions for one breath of air. Yet there is danger in boasting. Suppose a prisoner has lived quietly for several years, and by good conduct won certain privileges. Suddenly, to the astonishment of his superiors, he becomes mutinous, plays the very devil, and even ventures upon some capital crime, such as murder, violation, etc. All wonder at the cause of this extraordinary conduct on the part of a man believed to be incapable of such a thing. But it is simply the convulsive manifestation of his personality, an instinctive melancholia, an uncontrollable desire for self-assertion which obscures his reason. It is a sort of epileptic fit, a spasm. Even so must a man who is buried alive and suddenly wakes up strike against the lid of his coffin. He tries to rise, to push it from him, though reason must convince him that his efforts are useless. Reason, however, has no part in this convulsion. It must not be forgotten that almost every act of self-assertion on the part of a convict is regarded as a crime. Accordingly, he takes no account of the importance or triviality of his act. A debauch is a debauch. Danger is danger. As well be hanged for a sheep as for a lamb. It is the first step that counts. Little by little, the man becomes excited, intoxicated, and can no longer contain himself. For that reason, it would be better not to drive him to extremes. Everybody would be much better for it. But how can that be managed?